calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, here we are, 912 days since the anthrax killer struck. When was the last time you heard about that act of domestic terrorism that just happened to only hit those Senate Democrats who were opposed to the Patriot Act? Or were in a position to block it, Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle took care of them quickly. 1,267 days since 9/11, 831 days since we began to search for weapons of mass destruction, 612 days since Joe Wilson's wife was outed in a act of treason, to quote the Elder Bush. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you on the 22nd of February, Tuesday. Going to be an interesting day for those of you listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. I'll also be filling in for Randy Rhodes on her program on Air America Radio this afternoon, so you can catch another 4 hours of Tom Hartman if you're so inclined after this program is over. This program running from noon to three. Lots on our schedule today. Fake news in our first hour. Fake news, pink triangles, UFOs. Will conservatives get called on the big lie technique? We have a Berlusconi alert for you. Is in our second hour, is every child Mia Kang and being left behind? And come to think of it, is our technology being left behind too? And we're going to get into this whole issue of, is Jeff Gannon the key to untangling the connection between Karl Rove and the White House and Dan Rather's rather painful experiences of late? The setup, as it were, there. Greetings to everybody in our chat room this morning, by the way. I haven't had a chance to type into it. We've been kind of busy here. If you want to get into our chat room, the number's 186. Excuse me. If you want to get into our chat room, it's TomHartman.com. We'll get you there. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The United Nations issued a what I think is rather unprecedented warning today, you know, dealing with some of the hard news stuff here first. This is a really serious concern about Afghanistan. Afghanistan, this from the Associated Press, an article by Stephen Graham. Afghanistan remains one of the world's least developed countries. Now get this, out of 178 nations in the world. And, you know, there's some pretty undeveloped countries out there. I've been in many of them. I can tell you firsthand. There are some real hell holes. I don't know how else to describe it. Places that you would not want to live. You would not even want to visit. In fact, the odds are if you visited for more than 24 hours, you would leave with some horrific disease like malaria or dengue fever. And be assaulted by, you know, starving people and all, you know, on and on it goes. So anyhow, of the 178 nations that the United Nations surveyed, Afghanistan ranks 173rd. That means that there are only five countries in the world that are worse than Afghanistan in terms of development. Now, what's really interesting is that there are two ways to look at this, two sides to this story, as it were. First of all, let me lay out the perspective that's being put forth by the United Nations and the advocates of development in Afghanistan, which, of course, includes big time former Unocal oil company executive Hamid Karzai, who is now the president of Afghanistan, where Unocal wanted to build the gas pipeline, you will remember, before the war. Hamid Karzai is one of the big advocates for developing his country, in quotes. And in fact, he wrote the foreword to this study that the United Nations just published. And let me just lay a couple of sentences from this AP, this Associated Press story on you. Afghanistan remains one of the world's least developed countries, the United Nations said Monday, warning that the nation which harbored Al-Qaeda terrorists until 2001 could fail again unless more is done to lift it from poverty. Now, that's assuming that it hasn't failed already in large part. We now know that some 90% of the landmass of Afghanistan is outside the reach of Hamid Karzai and the United States. it has devolved into a narco-terror state, that Al-Qaeda is back in Afghanistan, that the Taliban is back in Afghanistan, that women are wearing the burqa again in Afghanistan. As pointed out, a new report examining Afghan security, welfare, and ability to control their own lives, the world body, that being the United Nations, ranked the country 173rd out of 178 surveyed, with only five states in sub-Saharan Africa faring worse. They go on to point out, now here's these are actual quotes from the UN report. Sustained peace in Afghanistan is not guaranteed, despite the early successes in state building. The price the international community would pay to protect itself from Afghanistan would be far greater than what it would pay to help develop the country. And then Karzai, in his foreword to this article, to this piece, he says, curbing corruption, bringing reconstruction gains to all regions of Afghanistan, drawing in foreign investment. I wonder how much of that from UNICAL. Well, that's it. Anyhow, drawing in foreign investment in a secure involvement and opening up the political process to participation remain the top priorities. This is Karzai, you know, the now presumably elected president of Afghanistan. As the country now turns a new leaf, our ambition is to give to each, is to give hope to each and every Afghan. Now, here's my concern. So very often, when we hear these internationalists, like Karzai and the multinational corporations and the World Bank and the WTO and many voices within the United Nations talk about the need for, the importance of, the imperative for development, what's standing right behind whoever is making that statement is a row of big multinational corporations that are looking at that country as a resource. They're saying, ah, cheap labor. Ah, bauxite. Hey, maybe there's tin there. I'll bet there's some oil. We could have gold mines here. We can have a pipeline across this country, you know, a gas pipeline. We can have, you know, whatever. What's on their mind is what can we extract from this country? And I can tell you from having worked in the third world, in countries on five continents, that very often, more often than not, when people talk development, particularly former corporate executives like Karzai, Hamid Karzai, oil industry executives, when they talk development, what they really mean is exploitation. And what you end up with is a state and a people who are dependent upon these large multinational corporations for pretty much everything. Which brings us back around to the United States, oddly enough. As we slide into third world status, into banana republic status, as we have gone from before, you know, when Jimmy Carter was president, before Ronald Reagan became president, we were the richest nation in the world, and more countries in the world owed us money than any other nation in the world. We were the world's primary lender. We were at the top of the heap. We manufactured some of the finest things in this nation. Our manufacturing capacity was second to none. And Reagan came in and said, that's silly. I mean, you know, for 200 years, we've had this kind of classical economics that says that it's a good thing, an important thing for a country to have its own manufacturing base, and it's a good and important thing for you to have a middle class, and that middle class should be represented by organized labor, and if you want to build an economy and strengthen an economy, you make sure that the people at the bottom of the economic heap have lots of economic opportunity because they're the ones who spend the money, and that's what generates demand. We've been saying that for a couple of hundred years. Really, we've been kind of running the world that way for a couple of thousand years, more or less. We certainly in the United States, we've been saying that since the founding of this country. And let's try something new. And as the story goes, Reagan had been at a luncheon with this, wild-eyed economist guy who said, I've got this Laffler. He says, well, I've got this curve here. Let me tell you about supply-side economics. It's a really good idea. Now, frankly, I don't believe that story for a minute. I mean, I believe that the lunch happened. But it wasn't something new that Reagan brought to the United States. It was something very old. It's called feudalism. F-E-U-D-A-L-I-S-M. It's the idea that a small group of very rich and powerful people will control everything, including the government. And he began us down that course, and we are well down that road right now in the United States. And this has been, you know, it's referred to in a number of different ways, conservative economics, the conservative agenda, the Republican agenda, you know, blah, 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 blah. And we have seen the results of it. People have to work two jobs now to have the same standard of living that back in 1979, 1980, when Reagan first came into power, one person could provide for a family. People are hysterical that their children have to get into college, and not just into college, but into the top colleges, which cost $40,000 a year, or else they're doomed to be flipping burgers forever. We have seen the hollowing out of America's manufacturing base, the wiping out of America's middle class. I mean, it's a very straightforward, very simple process. And we have seen the most rapid rise in wealth among the top 1% of Americans who own, at this moment, 90% of the wealth in America. We've seen the most rapid rise in income in the history of this country, with the exception of the 7 years leading up to 1929, which was the last time that this type of economic policy was tried. Herbert Hoover had the same idea. They just called it something different. I'm not sure that Herbert Hoover even had a name for it. But Reagan came along and he said, well, let's call it supply-side economics. Or, you know, and then the Democrats called it trickle-down economics. Well, the bottom line here is Afghanistan is facing the same problem. And what my suggestion is, both the United States and Afghanistan need to go back to the foundations. Let's go back to the fundamentals. A country should be able to support itself. It should be able to produce its own food, its own clothing, its own manufactured goods to a large extent. I'm not saying entirely. I'm not saying throw up the barriers. I'm not saying eliminate all trade. But Adam Smith's concept that he published in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, that trade was a good thing, was based on the idea that different countries had different things that they uniquely could produce because of their geography. That some countries would always produce better wine, other countries would always produce better cheese, and therefore if they traded, everybody would benefit. Well, there's still some reality to that. But the foundational stuff you have to have. And we are losing it here in this country. And now they're talking about in Afghanistan, developing the country in a way that I fear will lose it for them. Make them just another set of slaves to the multinational corporations. 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindfall.
This is the old Brush Show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What a friend we have in W. Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he's so resolute.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Yeah, well, you know, the court. Yeah.
Righteousness has filled our nation.
Well, okay, enough of that. People will tune in and think, what? What kind of station? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. Here's just to add to this, in the context of what's happening in the United States, since how much it's accelerated since George W. Bush became president. Looking at Bureau of Labor Department statistics, in the year 2000, they're looking at the long-term unemployed, and they have it broken out in this graph that I'm looking at. On one side, people who have less than a high school degree. Okay, that is people who never even graduated from high school. And on the other hand, on the other side, they have people with a bachelor's degree or more. That is people who graduated from college with at least a bachelor's degree or a master's degree or a PhD. And in 2000, when Bush came into office, the percentage of the long-term, the share of the long-term unemployed who had less than a high school degree was 29.5%, about a third, right? Almost 30%. And 14.2% of the long-term unemployed were people who had a bachelor's degree or more. Now that we have seen 4 years of George Bush's Labor Department and Commerce Department encouraging American multinationals not just to move their manufacturing overseas, as was done under Reagan's administration, with the secondary goal of the Reagan administration of destroying the union base in America, which they saw as a political enemy because it tended to fund the Democratic Party. Not only do we see, you know, that had happened up at that point, but then Bush comes into office and he says, hey, start exporting white-collar jobs as well. Now, to some extent, of course, to a large extent, the rise of the Internet made this possible. And in fact, this isn't something that we can entirely blame on George W. Bush. This happened on Bill Clinton's watch, too. And Clinton didn't do, in my opinion, a great deal about it. In fact, he exacerbated the problem with WTO and NAFTA and GATT and the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But in any case, we had about 29.5% less than high school, 14.2% more than college of the long-term unemployed. In 2003, the numbers were almost identical. 20.9% less than high school, 19.1% more than college. In other words, the number of people who are part of the long-term unemployed actually came down for those people who don't even have a high school degree. Why? Because those are the kind of jobs that are being created. You're hearing on all the right-wing talk shows, isn't it great? We have more jobs. This year, 2004, first year we actually created jobs. Look at this. We created 900,000 jobs. Jobs are being created. It's a great thing. What kind of jobs are being created? The kind of jobs that people who haven't even graduated from high school can fill and that have pay commensurate with that. So that share of the long-term unemployed has gone from 29% down to 20.9%. It's dropped by a third. But those people who have a college degree, and we'll talk about this later on in the program about what's going on at work, we're actually the Indian and Chinese companies are coming over to the United States now and hiring away our engineers and our executives in the high-tech fields. I mean, after they put out of business, put out of work, all the white-collar workers, in the college degree or greater, we've gone from 14.2% of the long-term unemployed in the year 2000 up to 19.1%, up to almost 20%. So that's about a 25% increase in just 4 years. A 25% increase in the long-term unemployed as among those people who have a college degree or greater. So even a college degree now won't protect you. Amazing. Amazing. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman program. Viagra for your brain. 29 minutes past the hour.
A party at Ed's house. Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Whatever you want, whatever you need, I will be right here waiting.
And, of course, Afghanistan and the economy are not the only things I want to talk about today. New anti-AARP campaign begins at home. Interesting opportunity to reflect back on how other cultures have dealt with some of these issues. First, let's take a couple phone calls. We have a few people who've been patiently waiting on the lines. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Patrick in Urbandale, Idaho, on the line. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the program.
It's Iowa.
Oh, it's Iowa. Okay.
Yes, it is. Don't
Thank
worry
you.
About it, Tom. Tom, I was reading in the February 20th, and if I'm wrong in relating the newspaper I read this in, I apologize. It was in the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And I did write a, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, I did write a, let's say, rebuttal op-ed on this, and I'm just going to go through this briefly, if I may, okay?
I'd rather you didn't read something.
Yeah, I will just not read it. I'm
okay,
trying
just
to
tell
give
us
the highlight.
Sure.
Okay? Yeah, it did initiate, I think it was, the name of the article was Now in Power, Conservatives Free to Differ. And boy, I've never seen an article, probably, that never, well, that initiated more, let's say, alarm and fear on my part, because it actually sounded like the actual goals they were presenting were parallel with fascism.
Yeah, the amazing thing, Patrick, is the points that I made in the first half hour of this program about countries being self-sufficient and,
right,
and having control over their own economies and those kinds of things. Those were the positions in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and before Ronald Reagan. Those were the positions of classical conservatives in the United States, and as well, most classical liberals. In other words, they were things that there was just an absolute consensus on, but the conservatives were fanatic about that stuff. And now what we have is that the people who are calling themselves conservatives have taken the position of corporatism in the United States, which, as you point out, is the dictionary definition of fascism. And the liberals, in quotes, are the people who are just the mainline midstream of America. And liberals and progressives, I mean, people who are really out there on the left, the socialists and those folks, they're trying to figure out how to rename themselves, you know, because they're like, anyhow, I interrupted you. You were saying.
Well, these phrases and terms were used, I think, almost consistently throughout the article, and they were quotes, all right?
Sure.
By these GOP geniuses who wanted George W. to, I guess what, recognize and follow them through, I guess would be.
Right. Now that they've given him the presidency, he owes it to follow their agenda, sort of thing.
All right. And just to make them short, faith and values were constantly emphasized.
Right.
Using God's name for political achievement.
Yeah.
Managing the moral conduct of individuals.
Yep.
Editing movies, television, music lyrics, and books to make Christian conservatives happy.
Yeah.
And when you reach that stage, you are reaching fascism.
Well, frankly, I'd have to disagree, Patrick. I'd say you're simply reaching a level of oppression of some sort. I mean, we're talking censorship here, by and large. Fascism is more of an economic system, the merger of an economic and political system. But the we have to acknowledge, I think both of us, we have always in the United States had certain levels, certain thresholds of censorship that as a culture and as a society we've agreed to. I mean, when I was a kid, the magazines that are now on the newsstands were behind the counter, you know, for example, and the kind of videos that I can now see on my cable system here. We have whatever it is, Adelphia, the company that just started, you know, XXX. Now, I unfortunately haven't watched any, so I can't say this from first-hand experience. Maybe I should. I don't know. But in any case, here on our cable system, they've just now made them available, and they're promoting it, you know,
well,
$15 or whatever.
Preemptive strikes, though, against Afghanistan and Iraq, though, what about this? There's a definite quote identical to many say our president has made in the past. This is the quote. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators.
Yeah, that's the quote that Hitler gave to the newspapers.
When he invaded Austria.
Right after the Anschluss. A week after the Anschluss, he said, even in their death, they will not stop lying. He was speaking in the newspapers. He said, we came not as tyrants, but as liberators.
Is fascism to a certain degree when they're lying?
Well, you're mixing two things, Patrick, or three things, and I have no problem with that, and I don't disagree with you that these are problematic, but I think that the debate that we need to have in the United States, and we need to have it without hysteria, we need to have it with some honesty, is at what point, you know, if we're going to have censorship in our society, and we always have in this society, and I think all civilized societies at some level say there are some things that we just don't find acceptable. Whether it's the extremes of things like child pornography or whether it's super violence, you know, snuff movies, things like that. There are just some things that we think that have the potential to damage our children or even our adults. And we don't find them acceptable. I think that it's okay and it's legitimate and it's even appropriate for us to have that debate. And I think it's appropriate for people who are taking a position in that debate on the basis of their religious beliefs to say so. I have no problem with that. The problem that I have is when one group comes in and says, okay, we're taking over now. This is the agenda. End of discussion. We're not even going to have the discussion. And particularly when it gets into these the area of singling out a group of Americans who are the way they are because they were born that way, and identifying them as the problem, as the threat to society. Specifically, I'm talking about all the gay bashing that's going on the right. And that I see as, you know, during Nazi times, they had to wear the pink triangle. I mean, that was the thing. Patrick, I got to move along, but thanks for starting me off on this. Let me just, in fact, take this to the next step. This anti-AARP campaign has just begun. And I said on the air on this program, I think it was yesterday. It might have been, well, today is Tuesday. It might have been last Friday, but I'm pretty sure it was yesterday. I pointed out that it was that the Swift Boat Veterans guys, you know, these different companies that had come together to make the Swift Boat Veterans phenomena happen, were coming together again to roll out this campaign to attack the AARP. And I suggested that they would probably attack them over something where the AARP was vulnerable, that being their support of this corrupt Medicare bill. Well, I was wrong. I had given them too much credit for integrity. The ad is out, and on the left-hand side, there's a photo of a U.S. soldier. On the right-hand side, there's a photo of two guys kissing. And then over the U.S. soldier, you see an X mark, and over the two guys kissing, there's a check mark. And at the very bottom, it says, the real AARP agenda. I mean, this is incredible. And the funny thing is you click on the ad and it just goes to the web page of this right wing bunch. They don't even try to say, well, here's that this is why they think that the AARP is in favor of gay marriage or opposed to our troops. They simply make the charge. It's just like the Swift Boats thing. They just make stuff up. They'll just, just pull it out and say, here it is. And there's a certain number of Americans, a certain percentage of Americans will say, yeah, sure enough. Paragraph 175 of the Criminal Code passed in 1935, right after Hitler took power in Germany. A male who commits a sex offense with another male or allows himself to be used by another male for a sex offense shall be punished with imprisonment, penal servitude up to 10 years, loss of civil rights. Persons convicted under these laws, this is paragraph 174, persons convicted under these laws also must wear a pink triangle. In 1933, this was just before this, they had enacted the law against dangerous habitual criminals and measures for protection and recovery. This gave the German judges the power to order compulsory castrations for crimes such as homosexual activity. The amendment to the law for the prevention of offspring with hereditary diseases, dated June 26, 1935, allowed castration indicated by reason of crime for men convicted under paragraph 175. That is the law that I just read you. And if you were chronic, if being castrated wasn't enough to stop you, the punishment for chronic homosexuals is incarceration in a concentration camp. This is the thing that concerns me, and it's not that I am pro or anti gay marriage, heterosexual, homosexual, anything like that. I mean, I'd be perfectly candid with you about my opinions on these topics. I think that gays should be allowed to marry. I mean, that's my own personal opinion. They're human beings too. I think that the Constitution gives rights to all of us. But I live in a state where gays have civil unions. That's not marriage. That's, whatever. Though that is not the issue in my mind. What is the issue is that we are repeating this stuff. And these conservatives are doing this. This is this whole Swift Boat Vets thing. It is the divide and conquer. It is what Patrick in Urbandale, Iowa, was talking about. Is come in and make somebody, some other human being, somebody else who was you know, born of woman and raised in you know, who had went through childhood, I mean, another living, breathing human being, and objectify them, make them a them, an it, the danger. This is a very dangerous road for society to be traveling. It's a very dangerous road. And these guys, they will do it with anything. Here, I'm on the spam list for the right wingers too, right? Peter Jennings is doing a 2-hour special on Thursday. Quoting from Peter Jennings, 40 million people believe they've seen UFOs, so this is of deep interest to people, end quote. So they're doing, on Thursday, Peter Jennings, ABC News, is doing a 2-hour special on UFOs. Okay. So I get this right-wing spam. Jennings has been brainwashed by the liberal media communist plot. Talking about UFOs. I mean, the cons will do anything. It has reached a point where there is a group of people who will do anything to split us apart. And it's ironic, isn't it, that I'm sitting here saying there's a group of people that will do this. Almost as if I'm doing the same thing. I mean, I acknowledge that irony. And my appeal to them, and this, he's a wishy-washy liberal. My appeal to them is let's recognize the humanity in each other. That's Rodney King. Can't we all get along? I really think Gandhi was right. I really think Jesus was right. I really think Martin Luther King was right. I really believe that those times that the United States has stood strong and tall in the world on behalf of the weakest among us, or the most oppressed among us, or the minorities among us, are the times when we have been the moral beacon for the world. And we must recover this. And these attacks now on the AARP, because they dare to challenge Bush on his Social Security privatization scheme, claiming that the AARP is pro-gay marriage and anti-troops. What? 1-866-889-8894. Dan in Rockford, Illinois on the line. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This sort of links to what you were just talking about, because over at the Daily Cause, there's this thing called Update GOP as a Shield for Roe Bush. But one of the things that it talks about is it has this thing. It's like the right-wing marching orders. It's a paper called The Integration of Theory and Practice, the Program for the New Traditionalist Movement by Eric Hulbeck, which
I have it.
Pardon?
I have it.
Yeah, and they actually say, you know, they use, it sounds like very much like Hitler type of language, where they say we will use guerrilla tactics to undermine their legitimacy. We will create a countervailing force. You know, we must be feared so that they will think twice before opening their mouths.
Sure.
And it's, you know, the other thing that, so that's an obvious.
And they've been very effectively and successfully doing this for 25 years now.
Will you write up our marching orders here on the left? Just formulate it and send it out to us.
That's the problem. I mean, you know, Will Rogers was right, Dan, when he said, I'm not a member of the Democratic Party, but when Will Rogers said, I'm not a member of an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. There are those of us, and I suspect you're among us, who believe in diversity, who believe, you know, that it's okay that there be a bunch of different opinions, that it's okay if there be people out there with extreme opinions, as long as they just be honest about it. And let's, you know, let's have these debates. So, for example, you know, at what point should we have, quote, censorship around things like, for example, pornography or violence? You know, where are those dividing lines? How should they be drawn? How should they be enforced? What are appropriate penalties?
Well, there's one of the amazing things about this post is that they talk about Grover Norquist talks about you know, a couple of years ago in a thing that he wanted the first thing that they've got to do. One of the main things they've got to do is take down all these pension funds, because pension funds have immense, I mean, trillions and trillions of dollars, and they're, you know, using their weight to you know, put some pressure on corporations to have proper governance.
Yes, and this is
and now Governor Schwarzenegger is firing people from Caltrans and CalPERS. There's these huge funds there, pension funds there, because
right.
that's exactly what they're trying to do.
You're exactly right. And when you drill down one layer down and look at the agenda behind the agenda, whether they're talking about religion or whether they're talking about pornography or whether they're talking about homosexuality or whether they're talking about, you know, whatever their wedge issue of the day is, the issue behind it all, at the bottom of it, is economic. It's all about economic dominance. It's about taking control of the American economic engine. Dan, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Well said. And these are the issues of our day, my friends. This and serious stuff that we have to face. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Working in a coal mine, going on down, now working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going on down, now working in a coal mine, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning.
There you go. Until nothing's left to extract, nothing but the extractive industries. This is where we started this hour with Afghanistan, talking about development. Just taking it out. Find out what are the natural resources a country has. Go in and get them. Take them out, whatever it may be. For many countries, it is the human beings themselves. Well, you don't take them out, you take their labor out. And that's you know, what we're seeing right now. And boom. The result, the loss of the middle class in the United States. A direct result. And in the midst of this, what is the majority party in Congress freaked out about? What is the group that controls the White House and the Supreme Court talking about? Where is the concern and hysteria? Well, I just got this email from the Traditional Values folks, traditionalvalues.org, and I quote, summary, the DreamWorks animated film Shrek 2 is billed as harmless entertainment, but contains subtle social messages. Parents who are thinking about taking their movies to see Shrek 2 may wish to consider the following. The movie features a male-to-female transgender in transition as an evil bartender. The character has a 5 o'clock shadow, wears a dress, and has female breasts. It's clear that he's a she-male. His voice is that of talk show host Larry King. This has these people hysterical. They are totally freaked out. Get over it, people. People change genders in our society. People are gay in our society. People are bisexual. We are the human race. I'm sorry. But what's really scary, frankly, is, well, and then they go through, and another scene in the movie, Shrek and the donkey need to be rescued from a dungeon where they're chained against the wall, and they go through this whole story. It's Pinocchio's nose and the whole bit. I mean, it's they are seeing even sex where there's no sex. But you link to their website, and they've got this incredibly sophisticated system where you just plug in you click on your state, and boom, they've got every newspaper, radio station, and television station in the state, and you can just click and send letters to the editors. It's really quite remarkable in a scary kind of way. In the meantime, the middle class of America is melting down. And this is what we're hysterical about. Where have we gone wrong?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd...
He's the man who... one covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from Oregon to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, being around the planet on radiopower.org, wayrosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and others. You find all the web links and drop into our chat room, our live chat room, if you'd like, at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We have lots of... It's going to be a fascinating... Is every child Mia Kang and being left behind? And come to think of it, is our technology being left behind as well? We're going to continue on from the theme that we started with the first hour of, you know, how does a nation make things work? How do you make a society work? Not, I don't mean in some intellectual academic context or whatever, but let me just wrap up. I mean, you know, in the practical stuff, I mean, how do you do it? How do you do it? Here we have unemployment rate and total unemployment, the share of unemployed 27 or more weeks. This is fascinating. The share of the long-term unemployed. In other words, when you look at total unemployment and you break out of that number, this is Bureau of Labor Department statistics, or Bureau of Labor Statistics information, BLS, the federal government agency. When you look at total unemployment, if you include in the long-term unemployed, and by the way, if you do that, the actual unemployment figures in the United States, if you include in the long-term unemployed and those people who are, by definition, by government definition, underemployed, that is, they're like, you know, mowing lawns and things. I mean, not part-time jobs, but less than that. Our actual unemployment rate in this country right now is around 10.6%. But in any case, if you look at just the percentage of the long-term unemployed as a percentage of total unemployment, in other words, let's look at the universe of all those people who are out of work. What chunk of them have been out of work for more than a year and a half? Long-term unemployed. They're not getting any benefits. The government doesn't even count them as unemployed anymore unless you dig down into the BLS statistics and look at, you know, Table C, Chart 6. And this is called unemployment rate and of total unemployment, the share unemployed 27 or more weeks. Okay, here we are. In the year 2000, when George Bush came into office, it was 11.4%. That is, of all the unemployed people in America, 11% of them, about 1 in 10, more or less, had been unemployed for a long time. Well, actually, in this case, I'd say a year and a half. In this case, it's just saying 27 or more weeks. That's half a year, right? 6 months or more. By 2003, we were up to 22.1%. It had nearly doubled, 21.8% last year. The actual unemployment rate has gone from 4% in 2000, 4.7% in 2001, 5.8% in 2002, 6.0% in 2003, down to 5.5% in 2004. Seems like a good thing, right? Unemployment rate going down. But the long-term unemployed going up, meaning that we're just not counting these people anymore. Just not counting them. Speaking of counting and of the news and of the press, I think it's a great time for us to have a Berlusconi alert. Our new Berlusconi alert music. You see, Silvio Berlusconi, George W. Bush, of course, is going to be meeting with him this week. Ah, yes. Well, actually, it's O Solo Mio in there somewhere. Here's how it works. Small-time crook, local mob guy, you know, whatever you want to call him, entrepreneur, let's say. Buys a radio station, buys a TV station, buys another radio station. Buys another TV station, buys a newspaper, buys another radio station, buys a radio network, buys a TV network, buys another radio network, buys another TV network, buys some more newspapers, until he owns all of the radio and television networks in the country. The only radio and television that is out of his control is the equivalent of public radio and public broadcasting, which is run by the government. And so once he's got the whole thing, he runs for public office. He decides to run for prime minister. And guess what? With the support of all the media, he wins! That's the story of Silvio Berlusconi. Well, now the Italian government has their panties in a wad. They are all upset. The Italian government has criticized the Swedish public service broadcaster Sveriges Television because a promotional film of theirs refers to the media situation in Italy. The film says that President Silvio Berlusconi was elected after a campaign on his own television channels and that he now also controls the state television. The theme music of the campaign is a mandolin version of the popular Italian song O Sole Mio. And the Italians are going nuts because the Swedes are playing this on TV and pointing out that Silvio Berlusconi owns all the media in Italy. The CEO of STV, this is the Swedish television company, Christina Jutterström, says that she doesn't have any plans to stop the campaign. This campaign, she says, is like Italian shoes. It's pointed and a bit uncomfortable. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. And our new Berlusconi theme music. Hope you like it. Speaking of control of the media, or attempts thereof, New York Post online edition, article by Kenneth Lovett. State Republican officials in New York, this in Albany, out of Albany, had egg on their faces after peddling a photo they erroneously said proved that convicted terrorist supporter Lynn Stewart was a Democratic Party activist. Well, if she's been convicted of a crime, she must be a Democrat, right? The state GOP chairman Stephen Mnarik and party executive director Ryan Moses gave the Post a photo taken at a Democratic protest outside last summer's Republican National Convention. They claimed it showed Stewart, a civil rights lawyer, pictured with Jesse Jackson, filmmaker Michael Moore, actor Danny Glover, and two Democratic council members. Problem is, the woman in the picture isn't Stewart. This is regardless of what you think of Lynn Stewart. I have some very real concerns about our government prosecuting lawyers for anybody. But I have to honestly say, I don't know enough about the facts in the case. I hope to learn as time goes on, and this stuff is like slowly coming up, but so much of it is under seal. I don't know enough about the facts in the case to offer you my own personal opinion on this. But regardless, turns out problem is the woman in the picture isn't Stewart. It's Leslie Kagan of United for Peace and Justice who organized the rally. Kagan and Stewart bear a slight resemblance. Mnarik's hometown newspaper, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, got duped, mentioning the picture as if it really were Stewart in a story that ran Wednesday and again in an editorial. In an editorial yesterday. Not exactly a Kodak moment for Chairman Mnarik, is it? Said Democratic National Committee spokesman Josh Earnest, who wants the GOP chair to apologize or resign. How about both? I guarantee you he will do neither. These folks are shameless. They are absolutely shameless. Congressional investigators, this from the Associated Press, warned federal agencies this week that the promotion of government policies through video news releases meant to look like TV news stories may violate federal rules against propaganda. May? In a letter sent Thursday to heads of government, this goes back to either, now I knew it one time, either 1951 or 1961. In one of those 2 years, it goes back sometime, it goes back more than 40 years. They began at the, every appropriations bill has, they began this policy of putting onto every appropriations bill a sentence at the either the very beginning or the very end of it, which says none of the money in this appropriation may be used for propaganda against the people of the United States or within the United States or directed toward the people of the United States. This started out with bills to fund, for example, the Voice of America and the overt programs that of propaganda that we were creating, where we may want to lie in what sounded like news, or certainly spin it, in order to help bring down the Soviet Union, bring down Castro, that kind of stuff. And they wanted to be sure that if we were inventing propaganda, if the government was creating news, fake news, that it was never directed toward its own people, toward we the people. But that would be just wrong. And so every appropriations bill since that time has had this language in it automatically. As the congressional investigators noted, in a letter sent Thursday to heads of government agencies and departments, the Government Accountability Office, this is not like the Democratic Party or anything like that. This is the Government Accountability as nonpartisan. The GAO noted that, quote, prepackaged news stories have become common tools of the public relations industry, end quote. They went on to say the presentations are intended to be indistinguishable from news segments broadcast to the public by independent television news organizations. Comptroller General David M. Walker warned that such productions may violate a government prohibition enacted in 1951. So, see, I was half right. In 1951, against the use of appropriated funds for propaganda. And that's when I first learned it. I've known that for some time, actually. Anyhow, I'm blithering. The White House Office of National Drug Control Policy was criticized last year for a series of video news releases in which a narrator, sometimes identified as Karen Ryan or Mike Morris, said she or he was reporting on the office's activities. The tapes were sent to local television stations for use in news programs. In a second case criticized by the GAO last year, the Health and Human Services Department's Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services produced video news releases touting changes to Medicare. Those productions were also narrated by Karen Ryan and were offered to local TV news operations. The GAO isn't saying that you guys are going to go to jail, but they're saying, hey, pay attention to the law, please. I mean, the GAO generally doesn't say, this is it, okay, you're nailed. But let's pay attention to the law here and not use taxpayer dollars to lobby or promote propaganda against we the people. It's just wrong. It's just simply wrong. And not only is it morally wrong, it's legally wrong. It's against the law. Again, there will be no congressional investigation of this because Tom DeLay, Denny Hastert, and Dr. Bill Frist, the man who knows how to bleed Medicare better than any other, will have nothing to do with it. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Is you glad you got nothing to feel? Is you glad that it's all so real? Hey, babe, somebody shine on me.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. And Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. And Victoria, are you really and truly in Brussels, Belgium?
Yep, I'm really and truly in Brussels, Belgium, the European headquarters of the Talk Radio News Service.
I am so impressed. Our senior international correspondent is with us. Victoria,
that's right.
What's going on over there?
Well, President Bush is, as you know, doing this major, sometimes being called a charm offensive, sometimes being called any number of things, but basically he's meeting everybody. He was at a major NATO summit this morning that I attended, or at least the bits you could attend. 26 heads of state, each one with an agenda, and his agenda seemed to be to try and work closer with the Europeans, and the Europeans wanted to try and work closer with the president. I think everybody was quite sincere in that. Of course, the means to doing it are quite different. And he said, interestingly, in his press conference after the event, that NATO is the single most successful alliance in the history of the world.
That's an interesting observation. I'd have to give some thought to that. But NATO has only, it's only been around about 40, 50 years.
I've been thinking of the history of the world myself.
Yeah, it's, I would think that, well, in any case, yeah, an interesting kind. Our president is not, you know, somebody who is afraid of hyperbole.
No, not at all. And, you know, he wanted to convey how strongly and highly he felt about NATO. And it was powerful, I must say, seeing Premier Yushchenko of Ukraine seated next to the head of NATO and also next to President Bush as he addressed the NATO assembly. You know, to see this man with a ravaged face who should be dead.
Yeah, and maybe a victim of Vladimir Putin, who was sitting around the table too, right? Or no, Putin is not part of NATO.
No.
Russia is not part of NATO. That's right.
That's right.
Oh,
it's one of those, if it's Wednesday, it must be Schroeder, and if
yes.
it's Thursday, it must be Putin.
Yes, yes. So what
I'm about to be busted.
You are?
Yeah, because you're going to hear where the headquarters of the Talk Radio News Service really is.
Oh, you're in the airport? Or the train station. That's okay.
I'm in the airport.
That's quite all right. Anything of consequence come out of this other than the fact that all of a sudden we are back to the same kind of relations with the rest of Europe that we had 4 years ago and that we should have had for the last 4 years if it weren't for the incompetence and arrogance of this administration?
Well, I think we're actually not really quite back to that because I just don't think that Europeans can really get over their innate dislike of President Bush, even as they do want the countries and continents to get closer. I think NATO's offer of help in training is frankly a big step because the U.S. can't do it all and does need help. The European Union is going to be offering to open an office there later in the year for training of judges and various other people. I think there is a demonstration to other parts of the world that even with disagreement, that NATO, Europe, and the U.S. can basically get along. But I have to say, I mean, I've talked to a lot of Europeans, and they're optimistic about the relationship with the U.S., but they have not changed their minds on Iraq one jot.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't expect them to. Do you think that they're changing their minds about George W. Bush?
No, I don't. I don't think they're changing their minds about him. They'd like to feel more positively about the U.S., but they're very nervous. They don't know where he's going to go next. They're not sure. They listen to his State of the Union address. They listen to the inaugural. They're worried.
Yeah, yeah. And if he goes off half-cocked after Syria or Iran, we had Scott Ritter on the program on yesterday morning, and Scott said that George has already signed off on a June 2005 attack of Iran.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't have gone down too well today. I mean, one thing that I am hearing is very positive is that there was great agreement with President Chirac of France in terms of Lebanon and Syria because Chirac was a great friend of Hariri, who was assassinated.
Yeah.
Feels very strongly that Lebanon should be autonomous. So that was one meeting of the minds and a good one.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hope this works out well for the United States and for the rest of the world. I mean, no matter what we think of our president, we do have to wish our country the best, and he's our president. So thanks for the info, Victoria. Victoria Jones
Thank of
the
you
Talk
very
Radio.
Much.
We'll talk to you soon. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service calling in live from Brussels, Belgium. 29 minutes past the hour.
And now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark. Kelly, how's it looking out there?
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where liberals fiendishly plot for total world domination. Any day now, right? Yeah. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to be on the program. Alice in Humboldt County is on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Tom, I spoke with you yesterday, and I'm told that you asked me a question as I was hanging up. You wanted to know when the Peace March is going to be here in Humboldt County.
Yes.
It will be March the 19th, and I understand they need some help putting it together.
Okay. Is there a telephone number or a website or anything that you would like to publicize?
Somebody was getting me the telephone number, but it's not here yet.
Okay.
It's Veterans for Peace Unitarians at the Congregational Church.
Okay.
I'll get a phone number for you.
Okay. Do that and call us back.
I'm sorry I didn't have that.
No, I think this is an important thing, and I'm just very pleased and impressed, Alice, that you're involved in this and promoting this and it's happening in a city that's, you know, one of our affiliate radio stations is located in.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't normally do PSAs on the air, but in this case I'm pleased to promote it. So if you get that phone number, call me back, we'll put it on the air.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Alice.
Okay.
Good to hear
from
you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you for the call. Okay. Here, no decision that puts Judith Miller on ice can be all bad. This from the Blue Meme. Now, of course, the reason for the opening sentence of this, Judith Miller is the New York Times reporter, along with the Time Magazine reporter. There's these two reporters who have been tentatively sentenced to jail, basically, for refusing to tell who it was who told them who leaked the information about Joe Wilson's wife that Bob Novak published. I mean, I just get the irony and the weirdness of this. You've got somebody inside the government who sets out to out a CIA agent and bring down one of the CIA's major counterterrorism operations during time of, quote, war against terror, end quote, in order to punish the husband of the woman who's in charge of that operation. Valerie Plame had set up corporations all over the country. 612 days ago this happened, by the way. Valerie Plame had set up operations all over the country, I mean, all over the world, rather, that were saying to terrorists, local terrorists, hey, if you want to buy some weapons, we got them wholesale. And they were front companies. These were front corporations that terrorists thought were weapons dealers that were actually the CIA. And Valerie Plame would travel all around the world and meet with the heads of these groups and meet with the people, the local terrorists who wanted to buy the weapons. Very successful program. And her husband then published in the New York Times an op-ed piece saying that George W. Bush had lied to us about the uranium in Niger situation. That in his State of the Union and in many of his other positions, Bush was lying to us about the rationale for war in Iraq. And it turns out, you know, retrospectively, he was lying to us. And it turns out when we look back at the events of the time, he knew at the time he was lying to us. In fact, he had removed that lie from a previous speech because he had been informed that it was a lie. But it got reinserted. And Condi Rice knew it was a lie. They all knew it was a lie. So Joe Wilson talks about this in the New York Times. His wife is running the CIA operation all around the world. She's a CIA agent. He's a former ambassador. And so somebody in the White House decides, we're going to nail this guy. How dare he? How dare he call the president a liar? And offer facts to prove it. How dare he? And so they call up a half a dozen reporters and say, hey, you want to know the identity of a CIA agent? Now, your average reporter would say, I think that it's a felony for you to tell me that. And that might be the end of it. Or, you know, if you tell me that, or let's say the person called up and said, hey, Carl here in the office, in the Oval Office, just wanted to let you know, Bob, that Valerie Plame's a CIA agent. She's Joe Wilson's wife. So now all of a sudden you know, right? And as a reporter, then you have this, you know, this choice to make. Do you publish this information and out a CIA agent and bring down a CIA operation that is a counterterrorism operation, or do you just sit on it and ignore it? And whoever this was in the White House had to call five or six different reporters before they finally found one who was so corrupt, so utterly lacking in morality or patriotism, that he was willing to publish this story. That being, of course, Robert Novak. A traitor to the United States. A man who, in my opinion, should be hauled up on treason charges. He published this information. And so now we have this administration prosecuting the reporters who didn't publish the story. Bob Novak is still on Crossfire every day. He's still on TV. You can see him on CNN every day. He's still writing his columns. He's still the darling of the right wing. But Judy Miller and this guy from the New York Times, or from Time Magazine, they're facing a year and a half in jail. For what? For refusing to say who told them the Valerie Plame was a CIA agent. And they didn't publish it. They didn't publish it. It's like, I could get in my car and drive down to the corner gas station and ram the car through the wall of the gas station, through the glass windows, and reach out through my window and grab a bunch of candy bars and drive back. This is just a mad momentary fantasy, okay? And then drive back here and commit several crimes in the process. I could even run a red light, but I don't. And I haven't. And I won't. But under this rationale, I could be prosecuted for thinking about it, for knowing about the possibility. It's perhaps an imperfect example, but basically Judy Miller and this other fellow, I don't have his name in front of me, are being prosecuted for not writing these stories. Well, they're being prosecuted for not telling where they got the information. But they didn't write the story. And the guy who wrote the story, he's scot-free. Now, that means one of two things. Either this administration is giving a pass to the right-winger, Bob Novak, who did his duty and outed as the CIA agent. Either they're doing that on the one hand. Or Bob Novak has already told the grand jury who it was. If Novak has already told the grand jury who it is, that's all they need to prosecute. In fact, there are five journalists who apparently received this information, and only two of them have been threatened with jail. So odds are the other three actually went in before the grand jury and sang. Now, I have a lot of concerns about this. We do have laws in this country that say that if you have knowledge of a crime and you fail to reveal that knowledge to law enforcement officials, it is a crime itself. And there are exemptions to those laws. Historically, for example, priests in the confessional have been exempt from those laws. Historically, psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, psychologists, and psychiatrists have been exempt from those laws. The theory being that these are people who are asserting or exerting such a positive social force in our society that it's worth giving up a little danger to society, that is, the person still running around loose without law enforcement knowing about it, in order to keep their function going. And there's even the hope that they may be able to reform these people. But that's really not the goal of it. The goal of giving exemptions to priests in the confessional and psychologists, psychotherapists and whatnot is not the hope that they will cause criminals to reform. It's the belief that having priests and having and ministers, you know, of all sorts and rabbis and whatnot, having religious counseling available and having psychological counseling available is actually an even more important thing to society than prosecuting criminals. Do you understand the logic here? This is very important. And historically, what we have said is also, there's another thing that is absolutely important to society. More important even than prosecuting criminals. As Thomas Jefferson wrote to James Curry on January 28, 1786, our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost. And so historically, what we have said is that reporters can protect their sources. Now, who is the judge? Or one of the judges. I believe it was a three-judge panel. But who was involved in this thing who decided, let's throw these guys in jail? Turns out, one of the judges was none other than Judge David Sentell. As the Arkansas Times, Arkansas's newspaper of politics and culture, noted in an article about Sentell in February 13th of this year, an article by Ernest Dumas, the Reagan-Bush Iranian connections. He's talking about Iran-Contra. Remember Iran-Contra back in 1980 when George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Casey, who was later made the head of the CIA, went to Paris and cut a deal with the Iranians. You guys hang on to the hostages until after the election so that Jimmy Carter's popularity will fall through the floor. And once we get into power, we will sell you weapons. We'll smuggle them via Israel, and we'll give you missiles. And in fact, they did. The hostages were released to the hour as Ronald Reagan was being sworn into office. And the missile sales began almost immediately, long before there were any other hostages in Lebanon or anywhere else in the world. This was obviously a quid pro quo. So, notes Ernest Dumas, Reagan-Bush's Iranian connections would prove troublesome in another 6 years when it was discovered that the White House was trading anti-aircraft missiles to Iran for hostages and using proceeds to finance a secret war in Nicaragua, both in flagrant violation of the law. A conservative Republican and former federal prosecutor and judge, Lawrence E. Walsh, this is a Republican, was put in charge of investigating what became known as Iran-Contra. Walsh obtained convictions of Reagan's top national security advisors and was closing in on Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, and maybe even the president, both of whom denied any knowledge of what their advisors were doing. He's about to nail George Bush Sr. Lawrence Walsh, the Republican. He's so horrified by this. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's been put in charge of this investigation. He's about to nail George Herbert Walker Bush. And Lawrence Silberman and his close friend David Sentell overturned the convictions, this of the underlings of Reagan and Bush, in a 2-to-1 ruling and established a standard that made it impossible to prosecute the violators. Walsh would describe this in his book Firewall in 1996. Quote, he said, a powerful band of Republican appointees waited like the strategic reserves of an embattled army. He went on to say, although the judiciary is theoretically a neutral arm of government and judges are expected to eschew partisan politics, the underlying political nature of all government institutions is evident. Walsh was fried. And who was it who saved George Bush Sr.? From being prosecuted for rigging an election in the United States and treason during the Iran-Contra investigations? It was David Sentell, Judge David Sentell. And who is it who just ruled that these two reporters who refused to publish a story outing Valerie Plame should go to jail? David Sentell, same judge. Isn't this interesting? And then, of course, we have what George W. Bush, the son of Bush Sr., had to say about the act of treason 612 days ago in his own administration.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official
who leaked.
Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
1-866-889-8840. 8894 is our telephone number. And Tim in Buffalo, New York is on the line. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a quick question about these reporters that are being prosecuted for not revealing a source.
Right.
How does anyone know that they had the source if they didn't print anything?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it.
I mean, how can they be prosecuted when they didn't print anything?
That's the thing. I mean, they're being prosecuted for not having committed a crime of outing a CIA agent. But in effect, I mean, it seems that way. Really, they're being prosecuted for having this knowledge. My guess is that they admitted that they knew, you know, that they did get a phone call from somebody, that they're not willing to lie before a federal grand jury. They're just not willing to say what was told to them. Tim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old Brush Show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So here we have the fake news folks pushing like crazy, promoting fake news here for the... This is not like Jon Stewart fake news. We're talking the Jeff Gannon fake news, the Republicans, not to mention the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services, producing fake news and sending it out. We've got the Department of Education producing fake news. We've got them hiring Armstrong Williams, and now, you know, we're up to, what, three people now that we know of? All of them saying, there's others out there. But three that we know of. And the real folks who are reporting the news, when they learn something that is a secret, are being threatened with jail. See, my concern about this, I absolutely get it and respect the fact that if somebody calls up any one of us, you know, any average person, for example, even me, I don't represent myself as a news organization or a news reporter. I am a commentator. I am a, you know, what... This is a giant op-ed. It's not a news story. I would even willingly exempt myself from this. But I say, if somebody calls up and confesses to a crime, basically, to anybody who's not a priest, a shrink, or a reporter, and that person doesn't report it, you know, I acknowledge that there's an obligation that we all have to society to keep the rest of us safe by saying, hey, I just heard that, I just learned that Ralph is a serial killer. I thought you'd want to know, to call the police and tell them. But when we stop protecting our reporters, then they can't do their job. See, here's what this administration is trying to stop from happening. What they don't want to happen. Somewhere inside the White House, not only is the person who leaked this information and outed a CIA agent and brought down an entire CIA operation and committed treason, not only is there someone in the White House who did that, but there's also somebody in the White House who knows who did it. And they want to make sure that that person doesn't talk to a reporter, because that person will be afraid that the reporter will be forced to reveal their source. You get this? This is CYA. On the part of the White House, through the vehicle of this judge who took George Bush Sr. off the hook. This is not a good day for democracy, my friends. This is not a good day. All the more reason.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
All the more reason for us all to get politically active.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plague?
Call calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Mia Kang, the new poster child for everything that's wrong with the American education. This is a remarkable story. This young girl, high school kid, finally stood up, a freshman, stood up and said no. It was a practice test for the SAT, and teachers call it a field test to give them a sense of how the kids are gonna do. You know, they want to know, because to a certain extent, the teacher's future depends upon it, as does the school's. It's interesting. We discovered that Rod Page, for example, the former Secretary of Education and the one who pushed through this whole No Child Left Behind thing, had been scamming the system when he was the head of the Houston Department of Schools. George W. Bush had run on this thing about how he had the lowest dropout rate in the country, and wasn't it wonderful? Well, it turned out that Page had been fudging the figures. He'd been doing Enron accounting. They had been moving failing kids out of the school district into other school districts, and then they would let them fall out of those school districts. Or they just, even after they dropped out, they would say that they were actually in another school district and were considering them transfers. So all of a sudden, they didn't have any dropouts in Houston. Wasn't it amazing? A couple of their suburbs were in bad shape. But in any case, here now we have this obsession with testing, with standardized testing. I remember when the No Child Left Behind Act was coming down the road. I wrote about this in a book called Unequal Protection, which I wrote that book 4 years ago. So it must have been 4 years ago that it was coming down the road. And during the first year of the Bush administration. And I contacted Jim Jeffords' office. Now, at that time, Jim Jeffords was still a Republican. And he's my senator here in the People's Republic of Vermont. And his office is just a few blocks from our studio here. And, you know, I called his office and said, you know, I'd like to know what you know about this No Child Left Behind Act. And the researcher, fellow staff person, whatever, that I spoke with there, it's been a few years, I don't recall his name, had said to me, well, we have some information on that that we would be glad to share with you. You know, come on by. And so I went down to the office, and he had quite a stack. And among the stuff that he had was a report that had been done by the Congressional Research Service. Now, the Congressional Research Service is it's an arm of Congress. It's really like an agency that is a federal agency that was created to serve Congress. You and I can't go to the Congressional Research Service and say, would you please look into the situation in Darfur? Or would you please look into the Houston Public Schools, or would you please look into this piece of legislation, or whatever. You know, we can't ask them to do that. Actually, I don't think that they would look into the situation. I think that their job is to look at legislation and the consequences of legislation and the issues around it. In any case, he had this report from the Congressional Research Service, which I quote in my book, Unequal Protection, the Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. He had this, Jim Jeffords had this research study that they had done, which showed that there was this small number of fairly politically active, that is to say, they give contributions to members of, you know, Congress, the Senate, running for governor, whatever, small group of some fairly large corporations, multi-million dollar corporations. One of them was a $400 million corporation, who were in the business of selling tests. Now, when you sell a test, you're selling basically an intellectual property. You're selling, you know, somebody has to sit down and write the test, and you hire somebody to do that, and then you sell the tests to the schools and say the school is paying 10 bucks for the test. Well, how much does it actually cost to print the test? A nickel? 3 cents? Something like that. I mean, it's incredibly profitable. It's a very, very profitable business. And so these companies had a lot of money to be lobbying politicians. And they went to the politicians and they said, you know, we're a $400 million company. We'd like to become a $800 million company. Why don't you make our tests mandatory? Why don't you force schools to buy our tests rather than just letting them? And that essentially is all that the No Child Left Behind program does, is it requires that schools buy the tests from these for-profit testing corporations. Now, here's, you know, I mean, seriously, the government could produce the tests, but they don't. And it would be a whole lot cheaper for the schools, I'm telling you. You got school districts all over the country that are freaking out because they can't afford these tests. Some of these tests, $10, $20, $30 per test, per student, for 25 pieces of paper. So the No Child Left Behind Act mandated testing and also put in penalties to the schools. I mean, the lipstick on the pig, as it were, that the patina on this thing was, well, we're going to do this to make sure that the schools are actually performing, that they're actually, that these kids are actually doing the work that they have to do, blah, 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 quack, 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 right? And, but in my opinion, and in Jim Jeffords' opinion, he didn't tell me this directly, but one of his aides said it in so many words, and certainly in the implicit in this research, Congressional Research Service report, although it does not, they do not draw conclusions. They simply lay out the facts. The major beneficiaries of the No Child Left Behind Act were the testing industry, which went from being an industry worth a few hundred million dollars to being an industry that's now worth billions. In other words, a bunch of fat cats got fatter. And the consequences of this have been devastating to our schools. And so now here we have students who are starting to say, enough is enough. Mia Kang was given a test, one of these, you know, No Child Left Behind tests. It was a practice test. She's a straight-A student, by the way. And instead of, I'm a quote for the story from the Express News, written by Jenny Lacoste Caputo. Instead of filling in the bubbles and making her teacher happy, Mia, a freshman at MacArthur High School, used her answer sheet to write an essay that challenged standardized testing and using test scores to judge children and rank schools. You get that? I mean, isn't this great? Instead of taking the test, instead of spending the time to take the test, she takes the time to write an anti-test essay. In fact, here's what she said. Here's Mia's own words. 14 years old. She says, I wrote about how standardized tests are hurting and not helping schools and kids. I just couldn't participate in something that I'm completely opposed to. End of quote. She went on to say that she was not just refusing to participate in the practice test, she was going to refuse to participate in the real tests. Now the school is really freaked out because the No Child Left Behind Act says, hey, if your kids don't do well in these tests, you don't get as much money. And so they dragged in two school guidance counselors to try and change her mind. Mia says, they warned me that it would be a black mark on my record and that I should choose my battles wisely. But she suggests, and as Jenny Lacoste Caputo notes, the author of this piece, many other students suggest, well, to quote from Jenny, Mia is the latest and growing number of students nationwide who are showing their opposition to high-stakes testing by putting down their pencils. Putting down their pencils. It's like nonviolent opposition. They're saying, you know, we're not going to play this game anymore, sorry. These young people, notes Jenny Caputo, Lacoste Caputo, these young people say the drill and kill mentality of test preparation is destroying their thirst for knowledge and creating a generation of students who are missing crucial lessons in critical thinking, creativity, and discovery. Frustration also grips teachers, but at least in Texas, it's students who are making their voices heard. It's Jenny Caputo at MacArthur High School. She says, enough is enough. See, there, in a way, this fits right in with this whole Reichwing mentality of let's not have our citizens, let's not have citizens who are thinking, let's not have citizens who are questioning, let's not have citizens who are, you know, able to engage in logical thought processes. Instead, let's just get some folks like bring them on in our chat room, who memorize a few talking points and recite them, and think that they understand complex issues in sound bites. This is just incredible. I mean, for example, listening to the archives of Monday's show, this is Diana in Florida. She's listening to our program, an archive of our program on the WhiteRoseSociety.org. She says, when I was in, and I talked about this yesterday, about the fact that we're not teaching the Constitution. Somebody had called in and said, why don't we teach the Constitution in our schools? And I said, you know, when I was a kid, they did. And when I went through elementary school, it was the 1950s. It was the late 1950s. And she says, when I was in junior high school back in the 1950s, so if she was in junior high school in the 50s, she must be a little older than me. She says, my eighth grade civics class spent at least one full semester, if not the full year, I don't remember, studying the U.S. Constitution. We went over every sentence with the teacher explaining to us the meaning and importance of each one. We memorized the preamble and the Bill of Rights. Now, I had to memorize the preamble and the Bill of Rights as well, along with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and along with the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence. I can still recite chunks of those, although badly. But, and that was when I was, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, something like that. Anyhow, she says, we had to learn all this. She says, if there is anything that should be placed on the wall of every schoolroom in America, it is not the Ten Commandments, but the U.S. Constitution, or at the very least, the preamble and the Bill of Rights. And then Diana goes on to say, it would be a worthy project of any heritage society, and I'm a member of the DAR and will suggest it to them, that we make it our mission to post the Constitution in every classroom in America. It is the Constitution, not the flag, to which school children and soldiers and politicians should pledge allegiance. And I would add, Diana, it is the Constitution to which the President, members of the House and Senate, in their oath of office, pledge their allegiance. To defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. That's what George Bush swore to do. But see, commandments don't require critical thinking. If you post 10 commandments, what you're doing is you're encouraging people to say, oh, I am being commanded to do something. I will do what I am commanded to do. But if you post the Constitution, you're going to require children to think. If you post the Declaration of Independence, you may even cause them to think about independence. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So many myths. Yes, people believe in stuff that ain't true. For 25 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program exposing the con in conservative. Now, what's the consequence, by the way, of this new philosophy of education that the Bush administration is you know, shoving down the throats of our children? Well, for example, Missouri. This is an op-ed piece that was published in the Sun News of the Northland, a newspaper in Missouri. An op-ed piece. and it's untitled. I'm not. It must have been an editorial. And Missouri's the headline: No Child Law Deemphasizes Humanities. We don't need those thinking humanities, right? Missouri school children used to have several areas in which they could follow their hearts, their God-given talents, and receive recognition, with all types of academic skills being treated equally and with respect. Notes the editorialist here. The new emphasis, in contrast, is crude. Well, that's a word I would use to describe the thought processes coming out of this administration. The focus is on fields in which students can, quote, make money, end quote, and, quote, compete globally, end quote, meaning the math and science fields, the feeder fields that serve the Bill Gates tech cult. History, fine art, and music are among disciplines that appear to have little value in the new order, and if some children are geniuses at sculpture but not calculus, too bad for them for possessing a skill that does not fit the prescribed mold. They go on to note that the future of such humanities offerings is threatened in the Missouri schools. They say to meet politically generated goals resulting from the ham-handed federal mandate of No Child Left Behind, state education leaders are doing what any cost-conscious and responsible group must do, making sure the state continues to receive federal money by forcing Missouri students to pass tests that emphasize what the Bush administration wants emphasized. Now you know why we're not studying the Constitution in our schools. Now you know why we're not studying the Declaration of Independence in our schools. It's not what the Bush administration wants studied. I mean, it's just very simple, very straightforward. Not some of both kinds of learning, massaging the right and left sides of the brain, exciting the imagination, and giving all students a rounded education, but a narrow focus that is more in line with establishing a human-to-robot outcome than with nurturing human beings to realize individual human potential. They talk about how the schools are being invented along what they call the pupil as parrot method. Pupil as parrot method. They don't have to learn how to learn. Instead, they have to learn how to parrot. How to repeat talking points. How to repeat factoids. They learn, for example, that 1 plus 1 is 2. But 1 plus 1 isn't always 2. What if, for example, you're talking about one donkey and one elephant? You now have do they have equal mass? No. So 1 plus 1 is 2 can be deceptive, right? The No Child Left Behind assault on the arts and social studies so far has drawn only slight recognition, they say. Although the National Education Association, what did Rod Paige call them? Traitors? Something like that. The National Education Association is concerned about this. Already the prospect of increased testing has schools cutting back on arts programs and subjects that aren't directly tested. Yes. Well, let's get into what this means for America in just a moment.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. We'll...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Young, it seemed that life was so wonderful and comfortable, 'cause we were powerful and in control. Then daddy's judges came through and they appointed me the president, with no precedent, Pennsylvania Avenue resident. So I entered a world that was full of complexity, much for me.
See, this is the thing. You get folks like George W. Bush and these, it's black and white conservatives, and they just don't know what to make of this stuff. It's like, What? You want to study the you want to study the Declaration of Independence? You want to understand the Enlightenment? You want to talk about John Locke? You want to talk about Rousseau and the social contract? You've got to be kidding. Bring him on, our erstwhile conservative in our chat room. Thank you for the link. Shared with us a link to an article on Newsmax.com. This apparently was originally published in the New York Post. As I recall, the New York Post is part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, right up there with Reverend Moon's Washington Times. In any case, it's called Educrats. That's the thing that's kind of the giveaway, right? Educrats. Oh, my. You know, the biggest bastions of bureaucracy in this nation are at General Electric, AT&T, Intel, RCA. The bureaucrats are in the schools. Red-faced educrats at New York City's Department of Education say they will personally apologize to PFC Rod Jacobs and his family for sending the Iraqi-bound GI a batch of letters purportedly written by sixth graders who trashed the troops as war criminals. I find this fascinating. Teacher Alex Kuhnhart told the New York Post that he assigned his students to write Jacobs as part of their social studies homework. But the majority of letters written Kuhnhart's kids produced sounded like they were written by Michael Moore. One girl told Jacobs that he is, quote, being forced to kill innocent people, end quote, and challenged him to name an Iraqi terrorist. I know I can't, she insisted. Well, that's interesting. I would challenge anybody in our chat room to name a single Iraqi terrorist. I mean, the one guy, Zakari, who's getting all the press, is Jordanian. Anyhow. And as our president said, there is no link between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. As George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush himself said. Another girl explained, I strongly feel this war is pointless. End quote. I don't see why this sounds like Michael Moore. I mean, this just sounds like more than half of America. A third letter predicted that because President Bush had been reelected, quote, only 50 or 100 soldiers will survive. Well, it's a kid writing this. I'd love to see the context. It's probably, well, who knows? My guess would be the context would be, you know, it's a tragedy. A fourth accused soldiers of, quote, destroying holy places like mosques, end quote. Well, gee. You got a kid who's watching the news. Jacobs told the Post in an interview from Camp Casey in Korea, where he awaits deployment to Iraq, quote, I think these letters were coached by the teacher or the parents of these children. It boggles my mind that children could think this stuff, end quote. Apparently, Jacobs only watches Fox News. So far, there's no word of any planned apology from teacher Kuhnhart, who oversaw the letter writing project. But New York City's Deputy School Chancellor Carmen Farina, who has a nephew serving in Iraq, plans to personally contact PFC Rob Jacobs and his family, Department spokeswoman Michelle McManus Higgins told the Post. You know, if I was the teacher and I had assigned to my kids to write a letter to somebody who was going off to Iraq, which seems like just a great thing to do, I would go through and read those letters before I handed them off to that person. And if there were any letters, well, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. Because, you know, I think that this article is mischaracterizing them. I didn't read anything in there that sounded anything like, you know, that the kids were telling the soldiers that they thought that they were evil, that they were bad. I mean, you had the kids saying, hey, this is an unjustified war. I'd like to see the whole letter. I mean, I might write a letter to him saying, hey, as I did when Joe, you know, a conservative in our chat room, a regular in our chat room, called and who has joined the Marine Corps and is shipping out. And he called this program last week. And I said on the air to him, I said, Joe, you know, God bless you. I think it's great that you are serving your country and you believe in this war and you're willing to put your body and your money and everything else where your mouth is. And I think that's great. But I still have to say, I think the war is wrong. I think it's harming the United States more than it's helping us. It's harming our interests around the world. It's led to the death of somewhere between 20, 30, 40,000 people and 100, 150,000 people, unnecessarily, in my opinion. And we haven't succeeded in, quote, liberating, end quote, anybody yet. And if we do, I think the price is too high. I think Saddam Hussein would have fallen eventually anyway. And these guys, dictatorships, they don't last forever unless we prop them up like we are with Saudi Arabia. So I'm guessing that these letters were more of that. But this is what education, frankly, should be. And you know, whether the teacher should have gone through and read them and said, okay, this is a letter that's going to insult this guy, so I'm not going to send this along. That's a judgment call. You know, when you think about it, it's really very patronizing. It's like essentially what the Post is saying is that the teacher should have protected an adult, this GI, from the thoughts of children. And it's really very patronizing. You know, the conservative take on this is that, well, our soldiers are just so dumb and so vulnerable, and, you know, we just can't allow them to be exposed to the opinions of these children. I mean, whoa. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Actually, I was going to call in. You need to play the music, and I forget what your music is, the attaboy to that little girl in Texas. What a brilliant lady.
I
love her.
You are absolutely right. And
She deserves the stroke.
There it goes.
There we go.
to Mia Kang, the jolly good fellow. We caught her doing something right. Yes, indeed.
I mean, that is so
well said,
unpatriotic,
right,
to teach kids how to think instead of telling them what to think.
Yeah. Well,
how
you know,
can the education system do that?
I know it's just remarkable. The old saying is education is not the filling of a bucket. Education is the lighting of a fire.
That's right.
And we have decided in the United States, to heck with the fires, we're just going to fill buckets.
And the thing is, what the kids learn learning algebra or math or typing or anything else doesn't talk about what their success is going to be. I mean, a kid that plays music is going to do better in life.
Right. And you know, when one and one is not two, Roy, if we were discussing this in the chat,
right,
in binary, one plus one is 1-0.
And it's just getting them in lockstep. But your comments about Joe and the letters to the guy going overseas,
yeah.
I faced that with my nephew a year ago when he was getting over there. I wanted to wish him well. I wanted him, you know, Godspeed, take care of you. But please, you know, take care of yourself, too.
Yeah.
And we had a fellow that was active in our group that was registering folks, a young guy, didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. He's now in the Marines. He's headed over there next month.
Yeah.
And this is a liberal. He knows that he's not over there to save the world. He's in there to grow up himself.
Yeah.
And it's the conflict of
his,
what kind
his
of
right
advice
of passage
you give this kid.
Yeah.
As they're getting to go out there to, quote, well, it's an economic draft. Economic.
Oh, yeah. Plan. Well, it is. It very much is. It very much is.
And it just really gets conflicting. As far as the teacher should have kind of prefaced it, that no matter what your feelings are toward the war, kind of support this guy and let him.
Well, the teacher may well have done that. All we saw in this Post article were not even entire sentences, fragments of sentences. And I think we all know how easy it is for particularly right-wingers to manipulate fragments of sentences.
If my son was still at home, his letter would have had a few of those phrases in because I would have been remiss had I not been educating him the way I feel.
Yeah, and let's keep in mind that in the only county in Ohio that actually reported the overseas military absentee vote, John Kerry beat George Bush almost 2-1.
Right.
And, you know, beyond that, I have not been able to find any other counties anywhere in the United States that have actually reported the overseas military vote. There was just that one, and that came out of the result of that lawsuit where the Greens went in and they were doing the recount. In that one county, they had to reveal what the military vote was. Kerry beat Bush 2-1. And so, you know, it's go figure. Anyhow, Roy, thanks for the call.
Have a good
to hear
one, Tom.
From you too. And what's the consequence of that? What's the outcome of this? See, the desirable outcome that the cons say you're going to get if you have an educational system that is increasingly just about learn what we tell you, do what we tell you, become a good little robot for society, blah, 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 blah. The kind of education system that Fichte promoted in Germany back in 1809 after the Kaiser was beaten at the Battle of Jena by Napoleon. And he went to Fichte and he said, tell me how to create an army that can beat Napoleon. And Fichte came back and he said, you've got to change your educational system. You've got to create compulsory schools. You've got to teach only single topics one at a time so that people don't think holistically, so that the kids learn how to think in individual slots. You've got to use a bell and time things so that they will get used to external authority. They have to go through a two-step process to ask a question, to discourage question asking. They must raise their hand and say, essentially saying, ask the question, may I ask a question, before they can ask the question. And if you do these things, Fichte said, then you will have an army that will do what they're told, will not question orders, and you will have also good folks for industry and good civil servants. And the Kaiser said, hey, great idea. And around 1812, 1813, thus was born our modern educational system in what was then Prussia. And it didn't come to the United States, by the way, until the late 1890s, when Horace Mann went over to Germany, paid his $500, said he studied at Fichte's feet. There's increasing evidence that he never met the guy. Came back here and started promoting this his first success was in Massachusetts. Going to Massachusetts, which it was run by Protestants. It was a state that had traditionally, it's where the Puritans came, you know, had traditionally had a Protestant government. And in the 1840s, when the potato famine happened in Ireland, which was what, 1843, 1848, somewhere in there, the potato famine, all these Irish were coming over. And now they were the second generation Irish. This was the 1880s, 1890s. And they were starting to get politically active. There's like a million of them in Boston. And a Protestant secret society had taken over the Boston legislature. They called themselves the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. Their motto was, I know nothing. They had a secret handshake, and they'd do the secret handshake and say, I know nothing! And that's how you'd know it was another member of the society, the secret society. It was a secret society that wasn't a secret, because they took over the legislature and proudly proclaimed it. In fact, in history books, they refer to this in Massachusetts. If you go to, if your kids grow up in that state, the Massachusetts history books, they refer to that era as the era of the know-nothing legislature. And know-nothing is in quotes, because they did know something, but they called themselves the know-nothings. And the whole way that Horace Mann sold this to the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, to the Massachusetts legislature, was this will break the back of the Catholics. Of the Catholic political power. Because once you take control of their educational system, you can raise a generation of children who will be compliant. And there were Catholic families who absolutely refused to send their kids to those compulsory public schools in Massachusetts, and who got in gun battles with the police. They had to militarize one of the suburbs of Boston. They had to bring in the National Guard, the state militia, and escort these kids to school at gunpoint. And thus we have compulsory public education. So, and it's had its ebbs and flows over the years. So what is this bringing us, this conservative education? Well, here's an article from the New York Times News Service by Robert Weissman, published in the Toronto Star. U.S. technology lead slips away, report says. The laments have been sounded for years, notes Weissman. U.S. research and development is falling off. Other countries are growing more competitive. American schools are turning out too few scientists and engineers. Now these clouds on the horizon may be converging into something like a perfect storm, according to a troubling report released last week by the American Electronics Association. While many of the trends they cite are familiar, at least one is new and ominous: a migration of foreign science and engineering talent from the United States to other countries in Europe and elsewhere. We're not turning out engineers anymore. And we're not now attracting foreigners to come here and study engineering. People like Andy Grove, who started Intel, who came here from Hungary. China now graduates four times as many engineers as the United States, while the European Union countries graduate three times as many. Now, that's not quite as bad as it sounds, because China has about four times our population, and the European Union has about almost three times our population. I think there's about 800 million altogether. It may be less than that if you don't include all the former East Bloc countries and Russia. I'm not sure. Anyhow, at the same time, the U.S. lead is slipping in technology patents and science and engineering doctoral degrees, but we can kick butt in oil-rich Iraq. We can field an army, sort of. And we know how important it is to have the Ten Commandments on the school walls, even if we haven't yet figured out that maybe it should be the Constitution instead, 10 minutes before the hour.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 4th.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
All right, welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour. Five and a half, actually. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. Here's the good news of all this. We've been talking about the collapse of education or our educational systems in the United States. And this is just like right across the board. When you get into this very rigid kind of thinking, this very black and white, it's we're only going to do it this way. This is it. This is no, nothing else accepted, no other. You have problems like, for example, as they're discussing in the chat room right now, for example, abortions have gone up under Bush. Why? Because nobody can talk legally to kids about alternatives, about birth control. Is that, they've been pandering to the ultra right conservative, mostly I would say Catholics or some Protestants, I suppose, are opposed to birth control too. But it seems like that's generally mostly the Catholic agenda. In any case, here we have now and we were just talking about how we're losing our engineers and our engineering students. Well, here's the good news. The state of Utah, and I got to tell you, these debates are going on all across the country, by the way. We're having this debate in Vermont here right now. But the state of Utah has actually taken a step. In the most specific challenge, this is from the New York Times, by any state to President Bush's signature education law, the Utah House of Representatives unanimously, now get this. This is 72 to nothing. They voted this way. 57 Republicans and 18 Democrats. I mean, you want a Republican state to pick Utah, right? Unanimously approved a bill on Tuesday requiring state officials to give higher priority to local educational goals than to those of the federal law and to spend as little state money as possible to comply with the No Child Left Behind law. The bill challenging the federal law, known as No Child Left Behind, will go to the Utah Senate, where it enjoys considerable support, says its sponsor, State Representative Margaret Dayton. Federal officials had sought to prevent the bill's passage. Do you get this? The federal government is inserting themselves into Utah politics, trying to say, don't pass that bill. And Utah officials said a delegation from the Department of Education was expected in Salt Lake City on Wednesday to lobby the Utah Senate. The federal government lobbying a state? Our goal was to maintain state sovereignty, Dayton said, moments before the 75-member Utah House voted 72 to nothing in favor of her bill with three lawmakers absent. Representative Stephen Urquhart, Majority Whip, we are strong supporters of President Bush, he says. But that doesn't mean the No Child Left Behind law isn't seriously flawed. But it's symptomatic of a mindset. This is just a symptom of a way of thinking that you see right across the board in the Bush administration and across the conservative spectrum, unfortunately, increasingly. not the old-time, you know, thoughtful William F. Buckley conservatives, but these rabid right-wingers of it's my way or the highway, you're with us or against us, it's black and white. And I'm sorry, life just isn't like that. The world just isn't like that. That kind of a simplistic worldview leads to things like the rise of the Third Reich. It is not useful. It's not good for the United States. It's not good for our kids. It's not good for our nation. And so I say congratulations to Utah on pushing back. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder.